This is recording. All right. So hyponatremia is really a problem of water balance. So that's like the most important take-home point here. And as we know, water constitutes approximately 55% to 60% of the total body water. And it's divided into intracellular, which is 2/3, extracellular, 1/3. You guys have all done this many times before. Sometimes it's a little hard to remember it. Out of the extracellular fluid, 1/4 is plasma and 3/4 is interstitial fluid. So in a 70-kilogram man, the total body water is about 42 liters, of which about 28 liters is intracellular and 14 is extracellular. And 3.5 liters, approximately, is in the vascular space. So osmotic pressure, again, something important because it determines how we evaluate hyponatremia. Osmotic forces are important in determining the distribution of water between the various compartments. Each compartment has one major solute which holds water within the compartment because it's primarily restricted to that compartment. Therefore, sodium is are mainly the extracellular osmoles, potassium, intracellular osmoles, the majority of them out. And there are many others, extracellular, intracellular. And plasma proteins help maintain the volumes of the intravascular spaces. So the extracellular and intracellular compartments are in osmotic equilibrium since cell membranes are freely permeable to water. If an osmotic gradient is established, the water will flow from one compartment of low osmolality to that of the high osmolality until osmotic pressures are equal. And this is what we see in hyponatremia, where you have lower osmolality in the extracellular compartment, so water flows in intracellularly, and if it happens acutely, you get edema, specifically cerebral edema. Urea does not affect the distribution of water, and therefore it's called an ineffective osmole. So it basically goes back and forth, intracellular to extracellular, unlike sodium and potassium, which are maintained within their compartments. So regulation of plasma osmolality and plasma sodium concentration is mediated by changes in water intake and water excretion. Water excretion is primarily mediated by antidiuretic hormone, which acts by increasing water reabsorption in the kidney, in the collecting tubules of the kidney. And water intake is mediated in part by the thirst mechanism. So just to go over how we actually dilute or concentrate our urine to get an idea. Again, very important because water reabsorption, excretion is occurring, is being regulated mainly through the kidney. So there are two main ways. One is the medullary concentration gradient, and the other one is antidiuretic hormone, which acts in the collecting tubule. So you have to have both these things working together. So in terms of medullary concentration gradient, as we know in the loop of Henle, you have the sodium-potassium 2-chloride pump, and it maintains the concentration gradient in the medulla of the sodium and potassium. Also, urea is another major component. And because the concentration in the medullary interstitium is high, it helps to reabsorb water from the collecting tubule. And the reabsorption of water through the collecting tubule is under the influence of antidiuretic hormone. So again, the more concentrated this gradient, ADH presence, you actually end up reabsorbing more water. So those are the two main components. The loop diuretics, as you know, act over here, and they dilute the concentration gradient in the medullary interstitium. So that's why, as you'll see, when we get hyponatremia, later on when we talk about diuretics causing hyponatremia, you don't see it very much with loop diuretics. Mostly it's hydrochlorothiazide. And one of the reasons is that loop diuretics affect the concentration gradient into the medullary interstitium. Does that make sense? Because, again, there are two main components. One is the medullary concentration gradient, water reabsorption under the effect of antidiuretic hormone. Just to highlight this a little bit more, This is when you have, this schematic here is when you have high antidiuretic hormone present, and this is when it's absent, and concentrated urine and dilute urine. And as you can see, as water flows through the tubules, and the white arrows are water diffusion, and the black arrows are sodium chloride. So as the urine is flowing through the tubules, you have increased reabsorption of sodium chloride, again, through the sodium potassium chloride channels, and therefore the urine becomes more dilute as it passes through. And under the effect of antidiuretic hormone, the water channels open up and you end up having water reabsorption. So it's the water channels that are opening up, and again the concentration gradients are pulling the water in, that you end up absorbing a lot of water. And as you go, the urine flows down to the tubules, and again this laser is not really working, but at the end you can see you have a very concentrated urine at 1200 milliosmoles. And the exact opposite is occurring in the other schematic, where again, as you can see, the urine osmolality is very much similar, but when ADH is absent, you're not reabsorbing the water, and the urine actually is becoming more dilute because you still are having some sodium reabsorption as you go down the collecting tubule. So you'll end up with a very dilute urine. So this is how we concentrate and dilute urine in the kidney, which is very important to control your water content in the body. So your maximum concentration is about 1200, and you can dilute your urine down to about 50 milliosmoles per kilo. So plasma osmolality in healthy adults is maintained within a normal range, 275 to 290 milliosmoles per kilo. So what's the stimulus for antidiuretic or AVP, arginine vasopressin? It's going to be used interchangeably in these slides. Release. So there are two main stimulus for AVP release. One is your plasma osmolality, and the other one is the decreased effective circulating volume. Both are very strong. This is what causes increase of antidiuretic hormone, which then works on the kidney and reabsorbs the max amount of water it can in the collecting tubule. So when you have either of these things, you have an increased thirst mechanism, which causes increased water intake, and you have an increased release of antidiuretic hormone, which causes decreased water excretion, increased water reabsorption, you have water retention, you bring down your plasma osmolality, and you increase your effective circulatory volume, and then the ADH release goes back to normal. And that's basically how you try and reestablish your volume and plasma osmolality. Just another schematic, just to highlight again, this is your plasma osmolality. As it goes above 280, you can see the ADH secretion starts to rise. And it's a very linear curve as your plasma osmolality increases. And the other thing is the units. In terms of plasma ADH, this is in picograms per ml. As compared to hypovolemic stimulus, actually that stimulus, though it does require a big drop in your blood volume to about over 5%, but the stimulus is stronger. So you have a higher release of ADH if your circulatory volume is affected as opposed to plasma osmolality. But again, you have to drop about 5% of your blood volume. So antidiuretic hormone is secreted in the synthesis. It's synthesized in the supraoptic and paranuclear nucleus. And it goes down to the posterior pituitary where it's stored, and then under the influence of either osmotic stimulus or non-osmotic stimulus, which is basically your circulatory volume, you have secretion of AVP, which then goes and acts on the collecting tubule and reabsorbs water under the effect of the water channels, which basically open up and reabsorb volume. Water. So there are two major receptors for arginine vasopressin, the V1, which is divided into V1A, V1B, and the V2 receptors. Activation of the V1 receptors induces vasoconstriction and enhancement of the prostaglandin release, and activation of the V2 receptors mediates the antidiuretic response. Okay, so this is another schematic in terms of how antidiuretic or arginine vasopressin is acting on the tubule. So this is actually the collecting tubule cell here. This is the lumen of the tubule where the urine is passing through. And this is the pericapillary where actually the blood is reabsorbing the water. So as your vasopressin is released and it's going through the blood, it binds to the V2 receptor. It activates the adenylase cyclase and promotes CMP production, which stimulates your protein kinase and phosphorylates the aquaporin 2. And this causes the aquaporin 2 to come out towards the cell membrane, and basically it opens up and reabsorbs water, takes it back, and the water goes out through the aquaporin 4 receptors as well as the ABP receptors. So basically that's how the aquaporins work. We have about 4 different aquaporins in the kidney tubule, but the only one that's under the effect of antidiuretic hormone is the aquaporin 2 receptor, which is in the collecting tubule. The rest of them are not affected by ADH release. So hyponatremia is something you probably see quite often as you're dealing with patients on the floor and in different severities. So it's the most common electrolyte disorder in hospitalized patients. And there was a study done in Nephrology Transplant 2006 which looked at almost 3,000 hospitalized patients over 3 months, and the incidence of hyponatremia was about 30%, and severe hyponatremia, which they defined as less than 125 milliequivalents per liter, was about 3%. So hyponatremia is generally defined as serum sodium level of under 136, but the definition of severe hyponatremia varies from 110, depending on what you're reading, to 125. So usually when your sodium level goes below 120 is when we start to get worried about CNS symptoms in terms of cerebral edema. So you know, you really need to take that very seriously. And you're probably more likely to see it in elderly patients admitted to the hospital. And this is for a few reasons. Number one, you have, as you get older, you lose some nephron function, so you have decline in renal function. And as you get renal dysfunction, your ability to excrete free water also decreases, or the ability to dilute your urine. Your thirst mechanism also decreases with age. So you have risks of volume depletion that we see quite often, elderly patients coming in who are volume depleted and sodium's a little bit low. Decreased ability to dilute your urine. And also the arginine vasopressin unit increase per unit of plasma osmolality is increased. So they're actually a little bit more sensitive in terms of ADH release as they grow older. Again, there was a study that looked at nursing home patients over the age of 60, and half of the patients had at least one episode of hyponatremia in a 12-month follow-up. So it's fairly common in the elderly geriatric population. So hyponatremia, again, is characterized by an excess of extracellular water in relative to extracellular sodium. So again, very, very important, mainly a problem of water balance. So if you start thinking of it that way, then it's easier to come up with a differential. You know, why is there extra water? Why is the kidney retaining water? Or why is there extra water in the body? And the total sodium content in these patients could be normal, it could be low, or it could even be increased. Again, as we showed, the excretion and absorption of free water in the kidneys is a hormone. I think that's pretty clear. Any questions so far? Okay. evaluation of hyponatremia. So what do we need to look for when you have a patient who comes in with hyponatremia? So the initial labs needed are serum osmolality, urine osmolality, and if it's greater, if the urine osmolality is greater than 100 millimoles per kilogram, there is elevated ADH present. Because if you're hyponatremic and your serum osmolality is low, really your ADH secretion should be very minimal and your osmolality should be below 100. Like we showed, you can go down to 50 or 80 milliosmoles per kilo, maximally dilute urine, in which case you're trying to get rid of all the excess water. Spot urine sodium. Other helpful labs are serum uric acid, which is usually low in SIDH, and salt wasting nephropathy. It's low in both of them. TSH, cortisol, and creatinine. As you know, you can't diagnose SIDH or SIAD if you either have hypothyroidism, adrenal insufficiency, or renal failure. So you do have to eliminate those. So pseudohyponatremia is basically when you're in the plasma, your sodium concentration is normal, but because of the excess lipid or plasma in patients who may have multiple myeloma, they have a lot of proteins or very high lipid levels, they're actually, even though in the plasma the concentration is normal, the way it is measured, it turns, because they're measuring in this total volume, it looks like it's hyponatremia, though the concentration is normal. And our lab actually does need to be told, you may have a patient with multiple myeloma who has a very high protein level, and you are coming up with consistently low sodium levels, but if you call the lab, they can actually correct for it. So it's not automatically corrected. So it's not something that used to be done 10 years ago, and now we don't see it anymore. You do still need to call the lab if you're seeing something like that. So the algorithm, again, I think this is a little bit small, but the algorithm hasn't changed for a long, long time. I think this is something you guys go through all the time in terms of evaluating hyponatremia. All right, so this is not working. So again, you want to, this is only looking at patients who have a low serum osmolality. So you want to start with assessing their volume status. So serum osmolality, you can have hyperosmolar, which is usually related to something that will cause hyperosmolality, like glucose, mannitol. Their sugars are really high. They've gotten an infusion of mannitol. And normal osmolality is usually, if with hyponatremia, it could be the pseudohyponatremia, which we just discussed. So it's really the low serum osmolality that we're going to talk about in the schematic. So you have to assess their volume status. If they're hypovolemic, euvolemic, or hypervolemic. And once you, and this is not as easy to do sometimes as you may think, because the difference between hypovolemia and euvolemia, we really try and assess, you know, do they have dry mucous membranes? Are they tachycardic? Are they orthostatic? And sometimes it's a lot more subtle than that, and it could be a difficult differentiation. But once you do assess their volume status, if they're hypovolemic, you want to see what their urine sodium is. And depending on their urine sodium levels, you can divide the differential up. So if it's greater than 20, really you're thinking of renal failure, diuretic use, mineralocorticoid deficiency. Osmotic diuresis. And if it's less, then again, something in which case you're losing volume, diarrhea, nausea, vomiting, or blood loss. Euvolemia, at this, basically it's glucocorticoid deficiency. And I can't read my own slide. It's too small. Okay. Hypothyroidism, stress, which causes ADH release, syndrome of inappropriate SIDH. And hypervolemia, again, looking at the urine sodium, if it's greater than 20, again, we're looking at renal failure, because you don't reabsorb your sodium the way you should when you have renal failure in the proximal tubule. And if it's less than 20, nephrotic syndrome, cirrhosis, or cardiac failure. Those are the common causes for hypervolemia. So hypovolemia associated with decreased total body sodium. And under this we come, we have GI losses or third space sequestered losses. Sodium will usually be low, and the urine is usually hyperosmolar. Again, because your kidneys are trying to hold on to fluid, and therefore it's more concentrated and hyperosmolar. In patients who have vomiting or metabolic alkalosis, you may not see the low urine sodium, because as the kidney's trying to, with the vomiting and metabolic alkalosis, as the kidney's trying to dump the bicarb, it dumps it as sodium bicarb. So actually your urine sodium may be greater than 20, but your chloride, however, will still be low. So if you have a patient that looks like they're volume depleted, yet their urine sodium is greater than 20, look at the urine chloride, because it may be, they're vomiting and their bicarb is up and they're dumping their sodium bicarb. Diuretics, this is of course associated with a high urine sodium, because that's how they work. They inhibit the reabsorption of sodium, and with sodium flows out water. So usually their urine sodium is high. And again, like I explained before, hyponatremia occurs almost exclusively with thiazide diuretics and not loop diuretics, because thiazide diuretics do not affect the concentration gradient of your medullary interstitium. And that's one of the factors that helps to reabsorb water. Again, for diuretics, women and elderly patients are more prone to it. And usually when you start a patient on a thiazide diuretic, you would see the hyponatremia within 2 weeks of the therapy. So it's not, very far out that you have to look for it. If you have the patient come back in 2-3 weeks, sodium's normal, they should be fine with the thiazide. Salt-losing nephropathy, it can occur with patients with advanced CKD, disorders such as Bartterman's and Gittleman's, which cause the loss of sodium from the loop of Henle or the distal tubule, and you get hyponatremia and hypovolemia. Mineral corticoid deficiency, because under the influence of aldosterone, you usually reabsorb sodium in the collecting tubule, and here therefore you don't, and your urine sodium is on the high side, and you have decreased extracellular volume, which then causes a stimulus for vasopressin release, and you retain free water and become hyponatremic. Osmotic diuresis, again, hyperglycemia, mannitol, and you will typically see a sodium of greater than 20, because usually with ketone urea, sodium flows out also with the ketones, and you usually see a high urine sodium. Cerebral salt wasting, and this is usually seen in patients who come in with CNS trauma, subarachnoid hemorrhage, and the thought is it's related to the release of the brain natriuretic peptide, and it results in increase in the sodium excretion from the kidney, and therefore hypovolemia. Hypervolemia associated with increased total body sodium. Again, I think it's almost self-explanatory in congestive heart failure and hepatic failure, even though your total body water overloaded or volume overloaded, you have a decreased intravascular circulating volume. So the kidney actually acts like your volume depleted, and therefore there is ADH release and retention of free water, and urine sodium is less than 20 because the kidney is trying to hang on to as much salt as it can so it can reabsorb the water as well. Nephrotic syndrome. So nephrotic syndrome, you can actually be total body water overloaded and intravascularly overloaded, and patients can act in different ways, but some of them may be intravascularly depleted because of a very low albumin and lowered plasma oncotic pressure. And also advanced CKD, somebody who's close to dialysis, they just cannot get rid of their free water, reabsorb their sodium the way a normal nephron should be able to do. Therefore, you have elevated urine sodium, as well as volume overload and hyponatremia from water retention. So hypernatremia that's associated with normal total body sodium is glucocorticoid deficiency, hypothyroidism. Again, actually, the way both of these work is still through increased excretion of antidiuretic hormone. With glucocorticoid deficiency, same thing, you lose your sodium, hypovolemia, increase ADH excretion, and free water retention. Hypothyroid also works through ADH release and retention of free water. Psychosis has been shown, you know, psychiatric patients, it may not necessarily be related to the medication, psychosis by itself can increase ADH release and also free water retention. Post-op hyponatremia, when they get a lot of hypotonic fluids, drugs, and syndrome of inappropriate diuresis, antidiuresis. So I think a couple of, starting a few years ago, they're actually now terming SIDH, SIAD, because it's not always inappropriate release of the hormone. So it's you under SIAD, you do have SIADH, where secretion of antidiuretic hormone is independent of serum osmolality. Reset osmostat, when antidiuretic hormone does become fully suppressed and it results in a dilute urine, but at a lower sodium than normal. So these patients, after a certain, once you go below sodium of, let's say, they're used to, their osmostat is used to a certain serum osmolality, but once you go below that, they do get release of the antidiuretic hormone and do end up excreting free water. And a way to tell the difference between these two, which we really don't do much clinically, is to actually give them free water. See, as their your serum osmolality goes down, do they then, the urine osmolality at a certain point, does it go down as well when they start dumping out their free water? And then there are some mutations in the water channels that regulate the ADH receptor. So it's not that there's inappropriate secretion of ADH or as a reset osmostat, it's just the receptor is not responding. Or actually it's responding to the AVP. Diagnostic criteria for syndrome of inappropriate antidiuresis, again, serum osmolality less than 275, urine osmolality greater than 100, clinical euvolemia, urine sodium greater than 40 millimoles per liter, and again, this does not always have to be the case because it, your urine sodium depends on your sodium intake, so if somebody's not eating too much salt, then they're not going to be dumping too much salt. Normal thyroid, adrenal, and renal function, and no recent use of antidiuretics. Other things you can look for is the plasma uric acid level, which is usually low. And two reasons for that in SIDH. One is you do have mild volume expansion with free water, and also effect of ADH in causing uric acid excretion through the kidney. So uric acid usually goes down. Your BUN is usually less than 10. You can look at the fractional excretion of sodium, which is usually greater than 1%, or of urea, which is greater than 55%. And also, if you give these patients normal saline, they don't correct their hyponatremia. That's another way to, you know, because a lot of times, again, the hypovolemic and the euvolemic, it may be a little difficult to tell. In the ER, they get started on normal saline, but you see their serum sodium is actually going down instead of up. And that's a clue that this is probably SIAD. So common drugs associated with hyponatremia, desmopressin, which is usually given to patients with coagulation disorders, pre-op. Cytoxan, which is cyclophosphamide, that we could see, especially in terms of chemo. The other drugs in here that are worth mentioning is, of course, antipsychotics, antidepressants. That's a big one we see all the time. And I think actually those are the big ones that we look at. Of course, thiazide diuretics, but that's not SIAD, that's hypovolemia. So hyponatremia that's not related to increased ADH secretion, because like we said, even in hypothyroidism, adrenal insufficiency, when you're volume overloaded with CHF, liver failure, it all goes back to decreased circulating volume and increased secretion of antidiuretic hormone. So when is hyponatremia actually not related to increased secretion of antidiuretic hormone? And if your urine osmolality is less than 100, it's usually cyclogenic polydipsia, where you're drinking so much water, you are overriding the kidney's ability to dilute the urine. So you're just drinking too much that the kidney cannot even dump, even when it brings your urine osmolality down to 50. And in that case, you end up retaining the free water and your sodium dilutes down. Or beer potomania, and that has to do with solute intake. So we'll go through that. If your urine osmolality is greater than 100, it's probably a reset osmostat. Or salt-losing nephropathy, again, this is actually a little, this is not quite correct, because eventually, even though you're losing a lot of salt, you get volume depletion and you do get elevation of your antidiuretic hormone. So this slide is, I have to fix it. So how does it work with low dietary solute intake, which is also called beer potomania clinically? How do you get hyponatremia due to that? And just to sort of explain that, most patients take in and excrete about 600 to about 1,000 milliosmoles per kilo. And these osmoles are usually consistent of salt and protein because carbohydrates usually get metabolized. And if a patient is taking in and excreting about 600 milliosmoles per kilo, and you can dilute down your urine to 60 milliosmoles per kilogram per liter, how much urine can you excrete a day? So it's sort of like simple math. You're taking in 600, you can only get rid of it, the maximum dilution at 60 milliosmoles per kilo per liter. So you have to pee out about 10 liters to get all the osmoles out if you're diluting it that low. So someone is taking in more than 10 liters of water, they're taking in 600 milliosmoles, they cannot get rid of all their free water and end up retaining free water and causing hyponatremia. So, for example, somebody who only takes in 240, which we see in patients like beer drinkers, that's why it's called beer potomania. These patients survive just, they're alcoholics, all they're doing is drinking beer, which is basically carbohydrates. So you're not getting proteins or salts in, and as we know, carbohydrates get metabolized. Or it's the typical, old lady who's surviving on tea and toast. So water and carbohydrates, again, they're not getting their proteins or salts in. So if they're taking very low amount of osmoles, like 240 milliosmoles per kilo, and the lowest your kidney can dilute down your urine is 60 milliosmoles per kilo per liter, then they can only excrete how many liters of urine a day? 4. Does that make sense? So if that person is, let's say, having a lot more water or a lot more tea, they're drinking more than 4 liters of tea a day, or having tons of beer, cases and cases, so they're getting more than 4 liters in, whatever extra water stays behind causes hyponatremia. Okay? And as soon as they see, so these patients, you probably, in the ER you have this alcoholic who comes in and you see right away the urine osmolality is really low. It's like 50, yet they're hyponatremic. That's one of the differentials that needs to go through your mind. And once you give them even a little bit of solute with normal saline, they sort of hang on to that and they're able to excrete out their free water with that solute. So they really respond very quickly to giving them solute. So in cyclogenic polydipsia, the same concept applies. If a patient's taking in 600 milliosmoles and you can only dilute your urine down to 60 milliosmoles per kilo per liter, you can only get water. And it's pretty common to see these patients on the psych floor. They drink liters and liters of water. So once you've diluted down as far as you can go, you can only get rid of about, depending on how many osmoles you're taking in. And after that, you start retaining your free water and become hyponatremic. So the range of symptoms of hyponatremia, you have non specific neurological symptoms. Confusion, headache is pretty common, nausea, vomiting, and muscle cramps. And sometimes when you see the patients who are having nausea, vomiting, or pain, you have to figure out what's coming first, because nausea, vomiting by itself is a stimulus for ADH release also, and can cause, if you're having severe enough nausea, vomiting post-chemo, or you're in a lot of pain, it can cause ADH release and hyponatremia as well. So, you have to see what came first. Severe neurological complications, seizures, brainstem herniation, coma, and death. So how does the brain adapt to hyponatremia? So osmotic cerebral edema that occurs with plasma hypoosmolality and hyponatremia affects both the intracellular and extracellular compartments in the gray and white matter. And the cerebral edema is counteracted by a process known as regulatory volume decrease that tries to normalize the cell volume. So you're having hyponatremia, it's hypoosmolar extracellularly, and again, what we talked about with osmotic compartments, it's going to compensate by putting, water's going to flow into the intracellular space, because you always want to regulate your osmolality. It's an equilibrium. So how the body tries to adapt to this is it tries to displace fluid from the interstitial to the cerebral spinal fluid, and from there into the systemic circulation. This is in the brain. And then from the brain, it tries to get rid of inorganic osmotically active solutes, including sodium chloride, which is lost within a few minutes, and potassium, which usually occurs over 3 hours. So what it's trying to do is trying to get rid of the osmoles from the intracellular, so some of the water can, try and flow out, and so the brain edema can be minimized. Then you have extrusion. After you get rid of your sodium chloride and potassium from the cells, the brain's trying to get rid of the organic osmolytes, primarily amino acids like myo-inositol, and that occurs over the next 48 hours. So in animal studies, they've seen that actually if this process wasn't in place, it would not be compatible with life. You would just have too much cerebral edema and herniation and die. So if you have acute hyponatremia, which occurs in less than 24 hours, it can overwhelm this protective mechanism, because again, you have the immediate response and then the prolonged response. And if it's gradual with greater than 48 hours, the swelling, the brain swelling, and the neurological symptoms can be minimized. So that's why it matters how quickly it happens, because again, the brain cells are trying to adapt, but there is a timeline that they can really adapt to this hyponatremia. So how do we correct hyponatremia? Either you restrict, again, because it's mainly a problem of water, you can restrict water intake, you can give salt, or you can give a vasopressin receptor antagonist, which we actually don't use here very much. We can get it, but we don't really, I think, have it readily available. And the choice of therapy is really governed by how severe the hyponatremia is or the symptoms are. So symptomatic or acute hyponatremia, somebody with hyponatremia with sodium less than 120 who's come in with mental status change and confusion, that needs more urgent treatment and quicker, because the brain has not been able to adapt to the cerebral edema. And usually you want to correct the serum sodium at 1.5 to 2 milliequivalents per hour in the first 4 hours. And then the total correction should still stay about the same, which is about 12 milliequivalents per day. In asymptomatic or chronic hyponatremia, you can go a lot slower, and you correct by about 0.5 milliequivalents per hour. Again, you don't want to correct more than 10 to 12 milliequivalents per day. So another take-home point is it's very important to follow their serum sodium, because you really need to know how quickly you are correcting it. And this is sometimes a problem when a patient comes in through the ER and they're not really checking the serum sodium and they get started on 3% normal saline, because you really need to regulate how fast the sodium is going up. So how do we calculate the rate of correction for severe symptomatic hyponatremia with 3% saline? So this is an example. If you have, let's say, 70 kilogram male with a serum sodium of 110, you want to calculate, this is for giving 3% saline. Do not use this for trying to give saline to patients, because we'll go through why that doesn't work. So basically, you calculate your sodium deficit, which in this case comes out to be 420 milliequivalents, and you want to correct at a rate of 1.5 milliequivalents per liter per hour, at least initially in the first 4 hours or so. And this basically, so when you make that correction over the first, first 6.5 hours, it comes out to 64 milliequivalents per liter. In 3% normal saline, you have 513 milliequivalents per liter of sodium. And therefore, for every 2 cc's of 3%, you have about 1 milliequivalent of sodium. So you'd have to give about 128 cc's per hour. And this is the rate of correction over the first 4 hours. You want to check labs every 2 hours, again, because it's severe hyponatremia. You don't want to overcorrect. And in the first, in the 24 hours, you don't want to go over again, over 10 to 12 milliequivalents per liter.
So it comes up to the 120 now, so from the formula?
128? Because...
No, the 120 minus 110.
Oh, 120. 120 is where, that's your goal. That's your goal. So whenever you have somebody who is symptomatic with severe hyponatremia, you want to get at least to 120 milliequivalents. You don't want to try and correct them to 140. So you want to get up to 120, and that's what you're figuring the rate of correction for.
A level of 130, you don't correct it?
If they come in with a level of 130,
yeah,
sodium, not with 3%, because that really should not be causing severe neurological changes with seizures or mental status change. A sodium of 130, you wouldn't be giving 3% for. So why not use normal saline alone to correct serum sodium in SIEDH? So this is something that you may see. I've seen it in the ICU. Somebody with hyponatremia, and let's say their serum sodium is 119, or they're not having neurological problems, or even 122, and you calculate the sodium deficit and actually just give it as normal saline, because you know how many milliequivalents of sodium you have in normal saline. So the reason this does not work in SIDH is basically, we're going to highlight it again. If that patient who has hyponatremia has a urine osmolality of 600 milliosmoles per kilo, and we give normal saline, which has 150 milliequivalents of both salt and 154 of chloride, approximately a total of 300 milliosmoles per liter, and sodium chloride excretion is intact. So remember, it's only an issue with water excretion. Sodium chloride is being excreted. Then basically, the 300 milliosmoles will be excreted in 500 cc's of urine, and it leaves behind about 500 cc's of free water. And you get worsening hyponatremia. So in SIDH, you need to have intake which is more concentrated than the urine. So that's important. You have to take in what's more concentrated than urine, otherwise you're just retaining free water. So such as water restriction with salt tablets, 3% saline depending on how severe the hyponatremia is, or saline with Lasix, because Lasix dilutes down your urine, and you can, in the meantime, you're giving the saline. So that can also work. So treatment of chronic hyponatremia due to SIED, restrict fluid intake, which is, you know, on the regular floor when you when we look at patients who have SIED, the first thing you'll see we'll recommend is fluid restriction. You encourage dietary intake of salt and protein. Again, it's osmols going in, and as we saw, that helps excretion of free water. Demicocycline or urea, not really used very frequently. In fact, I haven't actually ever used urea. It's very distasteful. And again, the whole thing is with urea to give a osmol to help the excretion of the water. And the demicocycline actually acts on the ADH receptor, but it has problems with liver toxicity, so anybody with liver failure, it's not good for. And vasopressin receptor antagonist, when it is available orally, which right now I don't believe they are yet, though they're studying it at this present time. Again, I think this is just a repeat of what I just said in terms of treatment of chronic hyponatremia. So the VAPTANs are the ADH or arginine vasopressin antagonists, receptor antagonists. Conivaptan is an IV agent that works on both V2 and V1 receptors, and you went through both the receptors. And it's approved by the FDA for treatment of euvolemic hyponatremia in hospitalized patients. Again, I think it's something we can get here if we ask for, but it's not readily available by the pharmacy, but they can get it for us. Lexivaptan, tolvaptan are oral agents. I don't believe they're out yet, but I can double check. And the main side effects of these is really thirst for these agents. So osmotic demyelination syndrome, this is what happens when you correct hyponatremia too quickly, and it's that dreaded sequelae that we're trying to avoid when we're watching our serum sodiums very carefully after giving patients 3% normal saline. So this results in dehydration of neurons and glia, which leads to the osmotic demyelination. Again, you overcorrect very quickly. The extracellular osmolality goes up. The water just flows out from the intracellular space into the extracellular space and causes dehydration. So the correction of hyponatremia, again, causes the efflux of water, and then it triggers a de-adaptation response. So all the organic and inorganic osmolytes that were lost in the regulatory volume decreased phenomena when they had hyponatremia have to sort of re-enter the brain to establish the osmotic gradient in the intracellular space, because we had extruded all the sodium chloride, the potassium, the amino acids, and so it sort of has to come back in to maintain that gradient. So the water, when it's flowing out from the cell, sort of equilibrates, and you don't get this severe dehydration, which causes osmotic demyelination syndrome. And so the uptake of these organic osmolytes is actually slower than the initial loss, so it takes longer. So that's why we have to be very careful how quickly we correct it. And people who have malnutrition, alcohol use, or hypokalemia are more at risk for this, because they don't have the amino acids, they're already malnourished. So in terms of bringing back in amino acids, if they're hypokalemic, trying to bring potassium intracellularly to create the osmotic gradient, they're deficient in. So they're actually more at risk for developing this. So this includes both central and extra pontine myelinosis. And it begins with lethargy, affect changes, mutism, dysarthria, spastic quadriplegia, and pseudobulbar palsy. You don't have to see this right away. You can see this actually a week later. You may correct somebody very quickly and they get discharged next day or two, then they come in a week later into the ER with neurological symptoms. So it's not something that you will necessarily see right away. Again, people who are more at risk for neurological complications, like we went through with acute cerebral edema and osmotic demyelination syndrome, is alcoholics, malnourished patients, hypokalemic burn victims. So anybody who are, low protein stores and low potassium or sodium stores. Okay, actually that's pretty much it for the hyponatremia, and we're finished on time. Do you guys have any questions? The hypothyroidism, yes, okay, so let me just go. So hypothyroidism, you know, from the posterior pituitary, you also have the thyroid releasing hormone that's being excreted in response to hypothyroidism. So it's the same place where antidiuretic hormones. So I think there is a little cross between the secretion of that and the antidiuretic hormone. So actually you get release of antidiuretic hormone in response to the hypothyroidism as well. It's one of the hormones. So there is some link between that. That's why you retain free water and become hyponatremic.
We had a patient in our service who had hyponatremia. Whenever we try to correct it, even if you do labs every 2 hours or every 4 hours, the jumps are very fast, even with controlled normal saline infusion. You stop it, you watch over a few hours. Do you give any fluids? You kind of watch how you manage that, like from a 119 observation in a matter of few hours goes up to 124, 125 straight away, and then you want to, you know, kind of stop or continue the fluid infusion. How do you manage?
Yeah, you know, it's not always very easy. Whenever we give these talks, everything is a nice category, you know, what to do. But in reality, it could be, you know, multifactorial. It doesn't have to be one thing. You could have a patient who has SIADH. Let's say they're having pain, nausea, vomiting, and they have elevated secretion of their ADH hormone, and then at the same time they come in volume depleted, which also further increases their ADH secretion. So you give them saline and their sodium comes up because that initial ADH from the hypovolemia, you've cut off that stimulus. Yet they still have something else that is causing SIADH. And then you continue giving saline and the sodium may start dropping. So it's not the same scenario as yours. The other thing is, again, you just have to, you know, watch their, try and slow down the saline rate if you're going too fast. And it could be that they're not maybe taking enough osmoles. Let's say it's somebody who has, is hypovolemic, but at the same time not eating anything. And they can't really dilute down their, they're diluting down their urine, but not enough to get rid of all their free water, and they need a little bit of solute. So you give them the saline, they hang on to that solute, excrete a lot of free water, their sodium comes up, and once you shut it off, it starts going down again, because again, they're not having any solute. So it doesn't have to be like one straight reason. It could be multifactorial, and at times it could be difficult. It's not always very, sometimes it's really easy. You know, thiazide diuretic, somebody comes in, and they're hypovolemic, you give them saline, stop the, and it comes up very nicely. And other times it could be a challenge. I think, I'm not sure what happened, we were following a lady who had malignancy, and her sodium was pretty hard to control. She had a lot of lower extremity edema because I think she had a lot of abdominal mass and malignancy. You have her? So we thought she was actually intravascular volume depleted because everywhere else she was dry, she's not eating too much. We gave her saline, even though initially when you look at her you think volume overload and you go down that pathway, but when we gave her saline, her sodium improved. She did well, but once you stop it, it sort of trends back down. And maybe she just wasn't taking in enough solute as well. So then, you know, we wanted to just increase the amount of salt and protein she was taking in, so make sure she was on supplements. So I'm not sure how she's doing now, but some cases are a little bit difficult. They're not so clear-cut. Okay. Anything else? Okay. So I hope you guys got a little better understanding of hyponatremia, and can't figure it out, call the renal fellow, but call them early. Don't call them late.
I had it lost.